Welcome to the Federal Society's Courthouse Steps Decision webinar call. Today, July 6, we discuss Vega v. Taco. My name is Jenny Mahoney, and I am Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us John Elwood. John is a partner in the Washington office of Arnold & Porter, where he heads the firm's appellate and Supreme Court practice. He has argued 9 cases before the Supreme Court of the United States and appeared before most of the federal courts of appeals. John is a graduate of Princeton University and Yale Law School. He served as a law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. He served in the U.S. Department of Justice as an assistant to the U.S. Solicitor General and as a senior deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel. John taught University of Virginia School of Law's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic for nearly a decade. He writes the Realist Watch feature on SCOTUS blog. Throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the Q&A box at the bottom of the screen so that our speaker will have access to them for when we turn to that portion of the webinar. With that, thank you for being with us today, John. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. In March 2014, Terrence Tico, which sounds like a name out of a law school hypothetical, was working as a nursing assistant at the Los Angeles County / University of Southern California Medical Center. A female patient who was being moved on a gurney for an emergency MRI accused Tico of lifting her gown and sexually assaulting her. The hospital staff reported the accusation to the LA County Sheriff's Department, and Deputy Carlos Vega questioned Tico at length at the hospital, and Tico eventually provided a written statement apologizing for inappropriately touching the patient's genitals. The parties dispute whether Vega used coercive techniques to extract the statement, but it is undisputed that he never informed Tico of his rights under Miranda versus Arizona. That case, of course, held that during custodial interrogation, police officers must inform a suspect that, quote, he has the right to remain silent, that anything he says can be used against him in a court of law, that he has the right to the presence of an attorney, and that if he cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for him prior to any questioning, unquote. Tico was arrested and charged in California state court with sexual offense. The judge of the trial denied Tico's request to exclude the statement, concluding that he had not been in police custody when he provided the statement, and thus the Miranda warnings weren't actually necessary. Despite admission of the statement, Tico was acquitted. Tico then filed suit in federal court against Deputy Vega and several other defendants under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Seeking damages for alleged violations of his constitutional rights, including, as relevant here, his Fifth Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination. Now, Section 1983 provides a cause of action against any person who acts under color of state law, who subjects a person or, quote, causes a person to be subjected to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws, unquote. Remember that last phrase in particular, secured by Constitution and laws. Tico asked the trial judge to instruct the jury that it was required to find that Vega had violated the First Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination if it determined that he took a statement from Tico in violation of Miranda and that the statement was then improperly used against Tico at his criminal trial. In other words, Tico basically asked for an instruction that equated violation of the Miranda right with compelled self-incrimination in violation of the Fifth Amendment. The district court declined, reasoning that Miranda established only a prophylactic rule and that such a rule could not alone provide a ground for Section 1983 liability. Instead, the jury was asked to decide whether Tico's Fifth Amendment right against coerced confession had been violated. Consistent with pre-Miranda Fifth Amendment case law, the court instructed the jury to basically look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding when the statement was taken to see whether it was improperly coercive or compelled, basically whether it overrode the Tico's ability to exercise his or her free will. The jury found in Vega's favor and Tico appealed. That brings us to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit panel was Kim Wardlaw, Mary Mergia, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Eric Miller. And that panel reversed. The court held that, quote, use of an un-Mirandized statement against the defendant in a criminal proceeding violates the Fifth Amendment and may support a Section 1983 claim, unquote. The panel acknowledged that the Supreme Court had repeatedly said that Miranda adopted prophylactic rules, but the panel concluded that after Dickerson versus United States, where the court held in the year 2000, that Congress could not overrule Miranda and restore voluntariness, which was the pre-Miranda touchstone of admissibility. And when the court there, the Supreme Court held in Dickerson, that basically the Miranda rulings were a constitutional rule, and as a result of that, the court held under Section 1983 that Miranda is indeed a right secured by the Constitution. And thus the panel remanded the case for a new trial. The Ninth Circuit denied Vega's petition for rehearing on bank, but Judge Patrick Bumate, joined by Judges Callahan, Okuda, Bennett, Ryan Nelson, Bress, and Van Dyke, a total of six judges, seven, filed a dissent from denial of rehearing, which got the Supreme Court's attention. It's also noteworthy that panel member Eric Miller, who's a former law clerk to Justice Thomas and a former assistant to the Solicitor General, wrote a concurrence in denial of rehearing on bank. He argued that Miranda was undoubtedly a judicially enforceable individual right, as shown by the fact that individuals can ask a court to vindicate it by suppressing a confession. And he said, as a result, it's a right secured by the Constitution. And he made the point that if Miranda is not secured by the Constitution, then why is Congress not allowed to dispense with it? The court heard oral argument in its last sitting of this year, that is April of 2022. And at argument, there were a fair number of justices who expressed concern that Dickerson, which again held that Miranda rule was a constitutional rule that Congress could not override, necessarily meant that a violation of Miranda had to be, to use the language of Section 1983, a deprivation of rights secured by the Constitution and laws. Most notably, Justice Thomas, who was a dissenter in Dickerson and had given Miranda a narrower reading in Chavez versus Martinez, as well as Chief Justice Roberts, both expressed concern that Dickerson basically made it, basically required it to be a 1983 violation. And I think that some of that questioning could be characterized as, you know, this is what a crazy former version of the Supreme Court has done, but we're stuck with it. Essentially that they didn't necessarily agree with what the former courts had done, what Miranda had done, what Dickerson had done, but that absent overruling, they were stuck with it. Justice Kagan, who for several terms has been a major champion of stare decisis and has criticized the court's departures from it, asked counsel for the police officer a fairly long question, 306 words long, so basically more than a full page, and a fairly pointed question suggesting that departures from stare decisis harm the court's legitimacy, and particularly doing anything that might impinge on Miranda would be particularly harmful here. She's obviously a very sophisticated insider who understands what's going on in the court. So it suggests to me that she wondered if conservatives on the court might want to carve back at Dickerson or even possibly at Miranda, although I think probably just at Dickerson. And she asked, or she said that basically Miranda was, quote, sort of central to people's understanding of the law, and that if you overturned it or undermined it or denigrated it, it would be, you know, it would have a kind of unsettling effect, not only on people's understanding of the criminal justice system, but on people's understanding of the court itself and the legitimacy of the court and the way it operates and the way the court sticks to what it says. So again, it suggests that she was pretty concerned that the court might do something harmful to Miranda or to Dickerson. The justices also spent a fair amount of time talking about proximate causation, because after all, what Vega did was extract a statement that was coerced, or at least in violation of Miranda. And he didn't introduce it at trial. That's what the prosecutor did. And he didn't admit it, which is what the judge did. So there was Vega argued there was a proximate causation problem. That brings us to the decision. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, which for, you know, people who know the court is usually a way of saying that the criminal defendant lost. The court reversed the Ninth Circuit by a 6-3 vote, essentially with all of the Republican appointees, all the more conservative members of the court and the majority, and the three more liberal members in dissent. The majority acknowledged that Dickerson said that Miranda warnings were constitutionally based, but they nevertheless represented merely prophylactic rules. And its prophylactic status was really central to the reasoning of the opinion. The word prophylactic appears 30 times in the majority opinion, which is only 16 pages long, meaning basically almost twice a page. Because the Miranda rule is prophylactic, that means that there will be situations during which an un-Mirandized suspect will make self-incriminating statements that weren't the result of compulsion. They were totally voluntary. And instead, Miranda warnings are designed to safeguard the right against coerced self-incrimination during custodial interrogation. That's all they are, according to the majority, and really that's undisputed. The majority noted that because Miranda was prophylactic, a lot of post-Miranda decisions found that the ballast of interests justified restrictions on Miranda that would not have been possible if Miranda represented an explanation of the meaning of the Fifth Amendment right. That is, if it was coextensive with the Fifth Amendment right, as opposed to just a set of rules designed to protect the right. The majority noted that the court had engaged in cost-benefit analysis in other cases to decide whether it made sense for the prophylactic rule to have consequences for the cases before the court. Thus, for example, in 1971's Harris versus New York, the court held that a statement obtained in violation of Miranda could be used to impeach the testimony of a defendant, even though an involuntary statement obtained in violation of the Fifth Amendment could not be used in that way. Likewise, the fruits of Miranda violations are not tainted, and evidence that results as a result of that can be admitted. For example, items found during a search that result from an un-Mirandized statement can be used. That's 1974's Michigan versus Tucker. But basically, and the court also acknowledged that where the court adopts a constitutional prophylactic rule of this nature, as it did in Dickerson, the rule has the status of a law of the United States that is binding on the states under the Supremacy Clause, since after all, Miranda was itself a case out of the state courts. But the Vega majority, and this is kind of as edgy as it got, the Vega majority said, you know, basically, quote, this was a bold and controversial claim of authority. That is the idea that they can adopt constitutionally based rules that states can't overrule and that Congress can't overrule. But we do not think that Dickerson can be understood any other way. The majority said that. And it's hard to tell whether that is Justice Alito himself chafing under Dickerson because he doesn't think there are votes to overrule it, and so he's stuck with Dickerson, or whether he's just putting that in the opinion to preempt a separate writing by Justice Thomas, who again was a Dickerson dissenter, or some combination of both of those things. And the court noted that it was a matter of debate whether the Supreme Court has the authority to create constitutionally based prophylactic rules that bind both federal and state courts. And that has, after all, been the subject of debate among judges and commentators. The majority cited, among other things, the dissent of Justice Scalia and Dickerson that Justice Thomas joined. But the majority also took pains to say that it was not questioning what the court did in Miranda or in Dickerson. They went out of the way to say, admittedly, I think in a footnote, that we accept Miranda on its own terms, and for the purposes of deciding this case, we follow its rationale. But finally, here is the critical step, and I suppose I should have done this earlier, but here is the critical step in the court's reasoning. The court notes that a Section 1983 claim may be based on the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the laws, unquote. And the majority acknowledged that it might be argued that Miranda rule constitutes federal law, such that an abridgment of those rules can therefore provide the ground for a Section 1983 claim. But the majority wrote, quote, whatever else may be said about this argument, it cannot succeed unless Tocqueau can persuade us that this law should be expanded to include the right to sue for damages under Section 1983. And this, I think, is the critical move in the court's analysis. Under one way of reading the law, and this is the dissent's way, when you're looking at rights secured by the laws, that would be the end of it, because unquestionably, there is a right not to have your confession introduced in the government's case in chief at trial that is judicially enforceable, and that is secured by the laws. under Section 1983. But the way that the majority instead looked, it was kind of a bit more tautological, that basically you suffer a deprivation secured by the rule of law only if the court says you have a remedy for 1983 purposes. And in other words, that for 1983 purposes, the law has a different application in criminal cases than it does in Section 1983 cases. The majority noted that a judicially crafted prophylactic rule should apply only where the benefits outweigh the costs. That is fairly basic Miranda doctrine. The court has said that, you know, zillions of times between the 1970s and today when it's been deciding what are the implications of a Miranda violation in a criminal trial. And so here it was applying essentially the same reasoning to the civil context. And here, the court found that the benefits of permitting the assertion of Miranda claim under 1983 would be slight, but the cost would be substantial. They said that Miranda rests on a pragmatic judgment about what is needed to stop the violation at trial of the Fifth Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination, and that the prophylactic purpose is served by suppression alone. And that you don't have to have a lot of other implications in order to protect that right adequately, to make sure that police have an adequate incentive to actually give these rights before they interrogate people. They said that essentially it was enough of a remedy to be able to suppress the statement, to suppress a confession, and that you didn't need to also have the ability to sue for damages. They said that allowing a claim, a civil claim like that, would disturb judicial economy by requiring federal court judges to basically pass on issues that had already been adjudicated in state courts, and that would also cause unnecessary friction between federal and state court systems. And the court therefore refused to, as it said, extend Miranda in the way Tocco requested. And they did say that except in unusual circumstances, the quote, exclusion of unworn statements should be a complete and sufficient remedy, unquote. Now, of course, it wasn't a complete and sufficient remedy for Tocco because the confession came in his case, but the judge said, the court said rather in the across a run of cases, it would be a complete and sufficient remedy. Justice Kagan dissented, joined by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor. She noted, of course, that Dickerson said in no uncertain terms that Miranda is a constitutional rule, and that under 1983 and everywhere else, the definition of a right was something that creates a specific obligation that is binding on a government unit, and that an individual may ask the judiciary to enforce. And that obviously describes the Miranda here, because a court would have no choice but to exclude an un-Mirandized confession from the prosecutor's case. And she quoted the Judge Miller concurring opinion on rehearing that I quoted earlier. Again, Judge Miller is a former Thomas clerk, and he put it, you know, Miranda indisputably creates individual rights that are judicially enforceable. Any prosecutor who doubts this can try to introduce an un-Mirandized confession and then watch what happens. And after all, Congress couldn't overrule it. Now, at bottom, I think I find the dissent more persuasive because Section 1983 appears to care more appears to care about the right that is protected in court. And that is a right protected by the laws. And if you look at Section 1983, I think the easiest understanding of it is that if the right is protected somewhere, that is, if it's protected in your criminal trial, that's what matters for determining, you know, deprivation of that, which arguably happened in Tocco's case. Should give you a cause of action under 1983. And I view that that is, you know, probably a more persuasive reading of what Section 1983 says than what the majority said. So I agree more with the dissenters than the majority on that regard. That said, I do feel like what the majority did here is fairly consistent with the policy treatment of Miranda by the Supreme Court over the last 40 or 50 years. Miranda has come up in a lot of circumstances, and the court has dealt with it again and again, trying to decide, you know, what happens because of a Miranda violation? How do we deal with that? And pretty much, aside from saying that you can't introduce a un-Mirandized confession in the case in chief, the Supreme Court has allowed most other treatments of that, or allowed most other uses of that. And they've also been very, you know, they've really looked to sort of policy on that, and they've given a lot of weight to the idea that it's usually enough of an incentive to police officers to exclude it from the case in chief at trial, that, you know, they aren't thinking about those other sorts of things. And so we don't really need to deter them in those ways. Anyway, that's my wrap up of the case. And I would be happy to turn it over now to questions from the audience.
All right, thank you for that. So what are the broader implications of this decision? There have been some public comments that suggest that this represents the death knell of Miranda.
That's definitely true. I mean, in the sense that there have been a lot of public commentary that you might say is kind of doomsaying. I spend entirely too much time on Twitter, and there's been a lot of it there, but there's, you know, some of it is on, you know, op-ed pages and on legal blogs. Like, for example, law professor Lanise Herbert of Howard Law School, wrote on SCOTUS blog that, quote, Miranda, one of the increasingly few cultural and court canons that binds us, has been injured, perhaps fatally, unquote. And that definitely strikes me as an overstatement. The basic holding of Miranda is the same now as it's been since 1966. And that is, when a suspect is in custody, they have to be Mirandized. And if you don't Mirandize them, their statement can't be admitted in the case in chief at trial. And as I say, the majority opinion, perhaps to get six votes, you know, a supermajority, went out of its way to say that it wasn't questioning Miranda and they don't disturb the decision in any way. What it does mean is that if you're a criminal defendant, your remedies are more limited. If you don't get the statement excluded at trial, you pretty much, which was the case for Terrence Tekoe, you're basically fresh out of remedies. You can't seek money damages. One thing I think we do have out of this case, and I think is fairly significant, is we finally have a clear rule on what remedies are available in the civil context. And previously, we had kind of a vague holding in Chavez versus Martinez, which was a case decided in the early 2000s, which involved a Miranda violation simpliciter. That is, there was never any effort to introduce the statement at trial. They just had an un-Mirandized statement that was taken. And the court held their plurality decision that it was not actionable, but they had no majority opinion for the court. Justice Thomas wrote an opinion for three justices of the court. Justice Souter, joined, I think, by Justice Stevens, wrote a separate separate concurrence in the judgment alone. And that, under the so-called Marx rule, was the decision of the court. And let me tell you, I wrote the brief for the SG's office in Chavez versus Martinez, and even I had a hard time understanding what the rule was there. But I think that we do now have a clear rule that there's no civil cause of action for violations of Miranda that was signed on to by a supermajority of the court. So that is another important implication of the decision in this case.
Okay. Another question that we have is, where does this case fit in the broader scheme of the Supreme Court's civil liability cases involving law enforcement?
I think it is of a piece with their other recent cases. In recent years, the justices have been fairly skeptical of civil liability for police officers. To pick up on one kind of controversial application, the justices have been asked repeatedly to overrule the doctrine of qualified immunity, where basically police won't be liable for violating the constitutional rights of a suspect unless the violation was clearly established at the time at a fairly granular level. That is, that it is pretty, it should have been essentially only bad faith police and incompetent police would have not realized they were violating the person's rights. Justice Thomas has expressed some misgivings about that at kind of a doctrinal level because he thinks it's ahistorical. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest among the Supreme Court for doing that, for increasing the ways that police officers can be sued. They've also consistently avoided expanding so-called Bivens liability, which is kind of the judge-created federal analog that is for federal police officers to Section 1983. Essentially, it's an implied right of action to sue police officers for violations of law. Law enforcement officials for violations of law. And just this term in Egbert versus Boole, the Supreme Court held, again, I think by a 6-3 vote, it might have been 5-4, they held that it wasn't applicable to Border Patrol officers arguing that that would have implicated sort of national security because of the role, obviously, in Border Patrol officers in securing the borders. But some people have said that as a result of all this, that law enforcement are less accountable than ever.
John, do we know how important this case is or how often this issue arises?
It kind of depends on what you mean by how often the issue arises, because there are a couple different steps here, which kind of map on to Chavez versus Martinez, again, just Miranda, un-Mirandized interrogation versus introduction at trial. And I think that people are interrogated without Miranda warnings, not infrequently. How's that for a mamby-pamby answer? A brief was filed in this case by the California Civil Rights Group that included, quite a lot of research showing that police agencies in that state, particularly the Los Angeles Police Department, trained agents to, quote, go outside of Miranda to question suspects without Miranda warnings and thereby lock them into their stories. So they essentially couldn't change their stories down the road, because even if you couldn't admit it in any of the affirmative case at trial, you could prevent defendants from adopting a contrary position, because after all, you could impeach them with that statement at trial. In addition, you can use that to get a search warrant that can get physical evidence, which could be brought in, because again, that is not tainted under Michigan versus Tucker. There's a separate question about how often do people who are interrogated without Miranda warnings have their confession improperly admitted against them at a criminal case, because that, after all, is what Chavez versus Martinez plurality indicated. That's really what Miranda is about, and which this case confirmed. This case kind of confirmed that Miranda is what the majority called a trial right, that it means that you can't have coerced confessions admitted against you at trial. That's what it means to be, compelled to be a witness against yourself. Just talking to a police officer outside of court isn't un-Mirandized. And that is arguably the more relevant question, because as I say, the majority says it's a trial right. And Tocco's lawyer at the hearing in this case, either because he was trying to downplay the significance of a win for him and thereby win votes, or because it's true, suggested that situation arises fairly infrequently. He said, quote, there have been a lot of these cases since Schorenberg, which was one of the first cases in the Seventh Circuit to agree with it to this proposition. He said, rather, there haven't been a lot of these cases. And then he said, in as many words, there are a handful of cases. This essentially doesn't come up that much. That seems plausible to me, although, obviously I'm not an expert on the law of kind of un-Mirandized confessions, but that seems plausible to me for a couple of reasons. First, Justice Alito, I actually saw somebody comment on this on Twitter just recently. He's not afraid to quote concessions against counsel. So I'm kind of surprised that he didn't draw this out, which is one of the reasons why I tend to doubt it. But the reason why I think that the counsel may have been right, that there really are just a handful of cases, is that the Miranda rule isn't that hard to implement. And custodial confessions that are un-Mirandized, are typically suppressed, and it's not infrequent to see that happen. And in addition to that, I think that under so-called the rule of Heck versus Humphrey, you have to have a favorable termination before you could sue civilly to challenge this under 1983. That is, you would have to have the statement against you admitted at court and still be acquitted, which is, fairly rare, because after all, the whole reason about being upset and wanting to suppress your statement under Miranda is because you think you'll probably be convicted. And so it's this relatively small subset of defendants who have a statement against them admitted improperly under Miranda, and yet that they're acquitted who can do it. And so as a consequence of that, this may not arise all that often.
Oh, another question that we have is, are there other court-created procedural rights that raise similar Section 1983 issues? For example, how about the exclusionary rule for evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment? Do criminal defendants assert Section 1983 claims when state courts fail to comply with the exclusionary rule?
I think that you can, but I think that is, I think that the majority would say that that's different, because the reason that the exclusionary rule is, or among the reasons why the exclusionary rule is controversial, is because under the kind of established doctrine, the Fourth Amendment violation takes place at the time of the search. The Fourth Amendment violation isn't the introduction of the fruits of that at trial. And so, as a consequence of that, it's a completed violation when the search is done improperly. Here, again, ordinarily, the exclusion of the coerced statement is enough of a remedy, and you know that takes care of it. I think there would be potentially kind of a kind of a quirk of the law that even though you would, my understanding of it, you would have a remedy for it under an improper search under Section 1983. You wouldn't have it for Miranda, a Miranda violation. I think that they would say that it's excusable because the focus of Miranda, again, Miranda is itself not a constitutional right. It is a prophylactic rule. And so there is a long tradition of essentially looking at the pros and cons. So I think that, that is a very long way of saying that even though there is some asymmetry between the Fourth Amendment right and the Miranda right in Section 1983, there's a reason for that, because it isn't, even though it is a constitutionally based rule, it is not itself what the Fifth Amendment right is. I think, and I don't know the answer to this. I think it would be a separate question whether introduction of a coerced confession that is an actual violation of the Fifth Amendment would be the cause of a 1983 claim. And I think that that's probably still open after this case, if it isn't already settled in favor of potential plaintiffs. I don't recall any discussion of that in the opinion in this case.
And John, is there anything that surprised you about this case?
There were a couple things about this case that surprised me. The first thing was that it surprised me a little that the court even took the case. Now, an alternative basis for affirmance, even though it's not a real vehicle problem, in the sense that like true vehicle problems, reasons why the court doesn't take the case, is if there's some obstacle that would keep them from deciding the issue, like the case has become moot, and so they wouldn't have constitutional authority to reach the question. That is a true vehicle issue. But as a practical matter, the court frequently treats alternative bases for affirmance as essentially vehicle problems. There are reasons to pass on a case, because even though Vega, the deputy here, lost in front of the Ninth Circuit, he could go back and say, look, they didn't even need Miranda warnings because it wasn't really custodial. That's what the state courts held. That's an alternative basis for affirmance. He might have, as I say, the proximate cause argument, although that seemed to have become narrowed over time. I think that the court nevertheless took it. It was kind of cert baity, because as I say, the dissent of a vast number or a really large number of Ninth Circuit judges, made the case seem kind of cert baity. In addition to that, there are certain courts that have a reputation for being a little bit off center or off basis. And, both the Ninth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit have that reputation for better or for worse. And so I think it maybe came to them with a little bit of a tailwind there. I was also interested by the fact, or surprised mildly, by the fact that Judge Miller, who was, a former government lawyer from the Solicitor General's office and a former Justice Thomas clerk, went the other way. Although my favorite thing in the whole world is judges who hold their nose when they think that the law requires one thing, even though their policy preferences go the other way. And so Judge Miller, who I think was holding his nose for that concurrence, goes up in my esteem. And then lastly, I think one thing that if you're interested enough to log on to this call and haven't read it yet, there's a brief by historians that was filed in this case that argues, I think, fairly persuasively in a way that was called out at oral argument, to say that there was an established tradition at the time of the founding of examining magistrates essentially giving something kind of like the Miranda warnings, although just part of the Miranda warnings, basically advising them of the right not to incriminate themselves and saying, look, I can ask the question, but you don't got to answer it. And that struck me as very interesting as somebody who is kind of an originalist myself, and somebody who is very, very much interested in sort of law office history. I found that as a very interesting little factoid. But again, it was just advising them that they have the right not to incriminate themselves. The right to have a lawyer presented for you didn't happen until just a few terms before Miranda. It was still new at the time, Gideon versus Wainwright, which is argued by somebody from my firm. But just a little plug there, even though it's a 58-year-old case.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, John, for the benefit of your time and expertise today. And I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Our next Courthouse Steps Decision webinar will take place this Friday, July 8th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern on West Virginia v. EPA. I will drop the registration link into the chat. You can also check out all upcoming webinars at fedsoc.org/teleforum. Thank you all for joining today. We are adjourned.